Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. For those who want to be good investors and good Muslims, there are significant challenges. For starters, make sure your portfolio is alcohol-free.
Muslims are not allowed to drink it. We're also not allowed to invest in it. And the same can go for gambling companies, pornography, pork products.
And then there's the Islamic ban on interest.
You cannot charge money for the use of money.
So how exactly are Muslims supposed to buy a house? Meanwhile, halfway around the world, personal finance in the Middle East is a contradiction in terms.
In Dubai, I've made more money than I ever have in my entire life. And yet, I've never felt more impoverished.
And if you're an American on a guided tour down the Nile, prepare to break the bank.
He told us how he sleeps in the boat and how much he loves Americans. He said the word tip a lot.
In this hour, the Middle East meets Middle America. It's a special edition of Marketplace Money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Money. Today we're changing things up a bit. We're devoting the entire show to the financial links between the Middle East and Middle America. It's part of a two-week special on all of the Marketplace programs. Welcome to The Middle East at Work.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Hi, Tess Vigeland here at the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles. And joining me from Cairo, Egypt, is my colleague and Marketplace Morning Report host, Scott Jago. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Tess. Greetings from Cairo.
Excellent. Well, greetings from good old Los Angeles. You know, we talk a lot on this show about how our finances are connected more and more to the rest of the world, the vaunted global economy. Well, it turns out some of our basic personal financial concerns are similar as well. Here in the U.S., the housing market has crashed. There's constant talk of recession. My grocery bill seems to climb every week. And some analysts are now predicting $4 a gallon gas by summertime. Scott, this is not a pretty picture here.
No, it's not. But those financial worries are certainly not confined to the United States. I'm hearing the exact same thing over here. We talked to a few people at a cafe, and this is what one Egyptian man said.
Of course, I worry about my children and my family, maybe excessively, because of what's happening in Egypt. The prices are changing at a very rapid speed. Before, prices didn't change except from one year to another, but now the prices change from one week to the next.
Unemployment is a big problem in Egypt. There's the official government statistic, about a 10% jobless rate. Then there's what people on the street say. You might want to triple that figure.
Ouch. But Scott, even with rampant unemployment, Egypt's economy is actually growing, isn't it?
Yeah, GDP grew by 7% last year, and it's expected to keep going. Egyptians are trying to court U.S. investors, but they have some competition in the Middle East. You have Dubai and Abu Dhabi, and those have really become the go-to places for investment.
And I think that's actually where we'll start today's show, looking at the financial relationship between the Middle East and Middle America. We've seen big headlines recently about sovereign wealth funds. These are governments, mostly in the Middle East right now, that are making substantial investments in U.S. companies, including financial powerhouses like Citibank and Morgan Stanley. But the investments go beyond Wall Street. These state-owned funds have bought stakes in Main Street as well. Church's Chicken, Caribou Coffee, and believe it or not, the department store Barney's New York. To talk about the Middle East-Middle America relationship, we turn to Professor Mahmoud El-Ghamel. He chairs the Islamic Finance Department at Rice University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tess. Thank you for inviting me.
Why is the U.S. such an attractive place for Middle East investors right now?
Well, it's the world's largest economy, and certainly the rule of law and the ability to diversify across different types of assets makes it a very attractive place. There was some exodus of Middle East funds in the aftermath of September 11, 2001, and that some of what we're seeing are these funds coming back to be reinvested in the U.S. But certainly what you hear from a number of the investors in the Middle East, including the so-called sovereign wealth funds, is that they view the financial sector in particular in the U.S. as being unfairly punished for some of the mistakes that were done in the middle of the credit bubble. And so they think that they're getting good value for their money by buying shares in our banks.
knowing that Middle East investors are interested in Citibank certainly makes sense. It's a large multinational corporation with huge, huge amounts of money. But church is chicken?
That's an interesting question, or caribou coffee. One of the reasons for looking at these types of food retail outlets in particular is that there is a segment of the market in the Middle East that is marketed as Islamic investment. And so you don't want to invest in Anheuser-Busch if you're going to market the instrument that eventually reaches the market as Islamic.
And that's because of Sharia laws outlawing alcohol and...
Correct, alcohol consumption. That's right. But the cleaner play, if you will, would be for companies that provide admissible products. So coffee is perfectly fine.
And Barney's?
Barney's is clean.
I guess clothes don't really present any sort of problem, do they?
That's right.
What does this foreign ownership mean to investors and consumers here in the U.S.? Should it matter to us whether Dubai or Qatar own chunks of, say, the NASDAQ stock exchange?
I think the debate that's ongoing now is more political than economic. The worry is always whether or not if a particular country were to acquire enough assets, they will start to exercise control. And again, this is cyclical. We noticed in the 1980s the mania about, oh, the Japanese are buying real estate and eventually they'll buy all of New York and we'll all have to spend our money in yen and so on. And that never materialized. So this is cyclical. It just so happens that oil prices are high right now and therefore these dollars have to go somewhere. To the extent that they buy American goods and American companies and American assets, they're allowing the dollar to stay relatively strong, which is helping to limit our inflation in the sense that our imports from other parts of the world are not getting that much more expensive.
What's the next trend in the Middle America-Middle East relationship?
I expect that if oil prices were to stay where they are, and the amount of petrodollar flow to the Middle East remains, you know, in the trillions of dollars that we're forecasting over the next 10 years or so, then you would expect that more and more real estate, mortgage-backed securities, credit card receivables, all of these asset-backed securities that we've been hearing about a lot will be sought after by investors from the Middle East and from elsewhere. Over time, if people are relaxed about not caring whether the person who buys a big chunk of a company's stock comes from Asia or the Middle East or North America or South America or anywhere else, that money is money and it should seek the highest rate of return, then things should continue smoothly and maybe we can weather the storm and have our economy back and running in no time.
Professor El Gamal, thank you for joining us in this look at Middle America and the Middle East.
You're most welcome.
Mahmoud El Gamal is chair of Islamic Economics, Finance, and Management at Rice University. And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
We said that Dubai's economy is plowing full steam ahead. In case you're skeptical, how about a couple of staggering numbers? Dubai's foreign trade grew by 30% last year, not including oil. And one out of every five construction cranes in the world is located in Dubai. Not surprisingly, foreign workers are coming in droves. Nearly 80% of the people who live in Dubai are expats, and that includes 20,000 U.S. citizens. We talked to a few of them.
My name is Matthias Letson, and I am a professional photographer. I've been in Dubai for 3.5 years now.
My name is Jessica Anderson. I'm a senior analyst at an international real estate development company. I've been in Dubai for a little over a year.
My name is Scott McMillan. I'm a freelance journalist. I've lived in Dubai since May 2006. I am 33 years old.
Yeah, I'm 30, actually.
I just turned 33. My wife works for an international car manufacturer. Before that, she worked for an international consulting firm. They flew us out here in the middle of January. I mean, in Boston, it's, you know, 2.5 meters of snow and slush. And I sat by the pool having a frosty cold Foster's beer in the middle of January. And I said to myself, this cramps isn't a bad deal.
They came for my interview in September of 2006. And they were experiencing record heat. I think the temperature was some ungodly number, like 48, 50 degrees Celsius, which I don't know what that is. I don't even want to know what that is in Fahrenheit. And I almost fainted. And a month later, I began working here. No matter how many people come to Dubai, there's always more work than there are people to actually do the work.
You know, I quite oftentimes wake up in the morning and I do a PR event for a magazine here.
Healthcare providers. And that vision that I'm referring to is really...
And then I do a fashion show for Harvey Nichols at night. Tuesday, I'm shooting the president of France in Abu Dhabi. People take chances on you because they have to.
There's opportunity here. That's what it comes down to. It is the opportunity to be someplace where it's just like, wow. I mean, look around. When I drive home at night, I still look up at these half-built skyscrapers and think that this is actually what the half-built Death Star looked like in Return of the Jedi, except it's actually real. I really expected, you know, this city populated by nothing but slimy Texas oil men, sheikhs, and Russian hookers. And I got here and I realized, like, oh, it seemed like actually a North American city.
I always compared Dubai to Miami. In fact, a Jordanian friend of mine who's been both to Dubai and Miami says that Dubai is just Miami with more clothes.
And you'll see people in full cover abaya and dishdasha eating at Johnny Rockets and the chili fries.
All of the stores that you would find in the United States, you can find here.
Shopping is a national pastime here, and it's easier to spend money here than it is in Las Vegas, believe it or not.
The rental rates are worse than any rental market in the United States other than probably Manhattan.
Going out is horrendously expensive. I mean, it's not horrendously expensive, but it's like London, which is horrendously expensive.
And actually, because Dubai is so expensive, people report that they save money actually leaving town for a few days.
We travel more now that we're here. This is a great hub with access to...
Gosh, Moscow, St. Petersburg, India...
Qatar, Bahrain, Yemen...
Thailand, Italy, Cyprus, within a matter of hours.
There's not much to complain about here.
Ooh, how would I rank it on a scale of 1 to 10? About 8.25 to 8.5. I think the only thing that really prevents me from giving it a 9 is the fact the internet is censored and they still open mail and... You know, the media in general is not quite as deregulated as I would like it to be. That's the only thing that's really keeping me from giving it a 9.
People who complain about Dubai remind me of that line in Gosford Park where the woman says, I can't think of anything in the world worse than breaking in a new maid.
Sean Cole produced our story. Coming up, buying a home poses unique problems for Muslims.
In Islamic law and Islamic beliefs, interest is forbidden.
Find out how an unusual mortgage process kept many out of the subprime mess. It's the Middle East meets Middle America on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and I am joined by my colleague Scott Jagow in Cairo. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Tess.
And this week we're bringing you our part of a special Marketplace series called The Middle East at Work. Today we're looking at some of the personal money issues that connect the Middle East and Middle America. And Scott, here's a big problem both here and there in Egypt, housing.
Ah, yes. Well, Cairo has about 18 million people, but it was designed for about a third of that or less. So you have what you might call slums spilling out into the desert, very informal housing communities. And these apartments are cramped. We visited a couple. People can't afford to live on their own, so you have adult children living with their parents. And then there's the issue of how you even buy a house. Interest is forbidden in Islam.
That's right. You can't charge interest, and you can't pay interest. So that made us wonder how Muslims here in the U.S. deal with their mortgages.
Hi.
Hi. Very nice meeting you.
Very nice meeting you as well. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, please, come on in.
Murad Zarug invited me to visit his home a few weeks ago, where his wife, Amina, cooked us a dinner of fish with a North African bread called kesra and a salad of diced roasted peppers and onion dressed in a rich, fruity olive oil from their home country of Algeria.
It smells wonderful.
Oh, well, I hope that you like it as well.
Murad is 43. His wife, Amina, is 34. They, their 8-year-old daughter, Hannah, and 5-year-old son, Yusuf, live in a 3-bedroom, 2-bath ranch house in Pasadena, California.
We've been living here for a little over 5 years. Mm-hmm. We bought it in the summer of 2002. We're first-time buyers, and we like the neighborhood very much. The house is about the size of what we're looking for.
But there was one potential hitch in the plan.
In Islamic law and Islamic beliefs, interest is forbidden.
That means a conventional U.S. mortgage is not an option for observant Muslims. So Zarug and his family turned to American finance house La Riba, the largest Islamic mortgage lender in the country. La Riba means riba-free, and riba is the Islamic word for interest.
You cannot charge money for the use of money.
Dr. Yahya Abdul Rahman is the bank's founder.
That is what the Old Testament teaches and the New Testament teaches, the Jewish Bible teaches, and the Quran teaches. They all agree that money is a thing. We call it socially responsible, faith-based financing, which is essentially what Jimmy Stewart was trying to do in his movie, It's a Wonderful Life.
Just remember this, Mr. Potter, that this rabble you're talking about, they do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. Well, is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath?
My job as a banker is not to dig a deeper hole of debt for my customer.
So Abdul Rahman devised a way to finance mortgages without charging interest. It's essentially a lease to own, but you take title on the house. To determine your repayment, you and the bank get estimates from 6 different realtors about what the house is worth as a rental. Then you negotiate a monthly payment based on those figures. The bank makes its money off part of that payment. Abdul Rahman says not only does this process avoid interest, but because rental rates are a good indicator of home value, it means the bank and its customers won't overpay for properties. He cites the example of a friend who wanted to buy a home in Phoenix.
And the real estate broker was pushing him to buy a home for $286,000. We did our due diligence. It turned out that our assessment of the value of this home is about $200,000. Based on the rental evaluation, the broker called us up and he scolded us. And we still told him, don't buy the house. This house today is about $185,000.
The process of using rental rates to determine a home's real value kept American Finance House out of the subprime mess. The bank has had no foreclosures in its portfolio.
Finishes his dinner today, he's going to be the champion. Okay, Yusuf, Hannah?
Murad Zarug says even though Muslim mortgages might seem more complicated than what most Americans are used to, the biggest difference is in how monthly payments are set and what those payments are based on. Zarug says given the current housing market morass, traditional banks could learn a lesson or two from La Riba.
I think this would, at least in my opinion, should serve as an example of what can be a fair model that look at what's reasonable, what can be paid. The bank itself would not lend to a person who they know is not able to pay back the loan.
Who knew that one day that would become a novel concept? We've got links to American Finance House La Riba, as well as other information about Muslim mortgages on our website, marketplace.org. You'll also find photos of the Zarug family and the North African dinner they cooked for me.
Okay, Tess, what's the response to people who might ask, isn't this just interest by another name?
Yes, that is the question that is asked. And it's kind of interesting because they actually end up doing the math backward to calculate what they call an implied interest rate. And that is so that the homeowner can take the federal tax deduction for mortgage interest. I asked Murad Zarug what his implied interest rate was, and it's 5.6%. That's actually on his official mortgage papers. He got his mortgage back in mid-2002, and interest rates then were around 6.5%. So he actually got a better deal by using this rental calculation that American Finance House La Riba does. And it really does show that they're not using traditional mortgage financing methods.
But of course, mortgages aren't the only interest-bearing loans. We wondered what happens with something like a student loan.
Yes, and we thought that topic was perfectly suited for another Marketplace Money reporter. Regular listeners to our series Educating RICO may remember this.
The amount required to pay your student loans in full is $52,611.85.
What?
Yes, RICO Galliano has struggled with his student loans since we first aired that tape back in 2004. But he discovered that's nothing compared to dealing with student loans under Sharia law.
I didn't think this would be a difficult assignment. Because, hey, if U.S. Airlines offer Sharia-compliant meals for flyers, I figured my big U.S. loan provider would offer Sharia-compliant loans, right? I'd just call and have them explain one to me.
How can I help you, Jenny?
Yeah, well, do you have any kind of student loan instrument that is Sharia law compliant, that is compliant with Islamic law? I took that as a no. And if you think that's unusual, think again. On the line with me is listener Asin Ahmed. He's an engineer who follows Sharia. And Asin, you did not have an easy time looking for a Sharia-compliant grad school loan.
Yes, I tried to do that, and I was just unsuccessful. I sent out a bunch of emails. There are very few of them that I found that were actually in the United States.
So how did you pay for grad school?
They gave me a scholarship, so I was able to do it with only the federal financial aid loans instead of the interest-bearing ones.
Something like a Stafford loan?
The equivalent of the Stafford loan for grad students.
And that's interest-free?
It does have interest. It's just that the government pays interest for you on it until 6 months after you graduate.
Oh.
I paid it off before that six-month window expired.
All right. Now, that's impressive and clever of you, if I may say. But honestly, you were still technically entering into a contract where interest was involved, right?
I actually thought I was doing something wrong in terms of Sharia by doing that. I just figured it was the least of several bad alternatives.
What were your other alternatives?
Taking out an interest-bearing loan or not go to grad school at all.
So, not much of a choice. But why? What is it about student loans, as opposed to, say, car loans, that's so difficult to fit into Sharia? Economist Kabir Hassan is editor of The Handbook on Islamic Banking.
Any financial transaction, in order to be halal or Sharia compliant, it has to involve a buying and selling of something tangible. A bank cannot loan money to you directly, but the bank can buy things for you and arrange your financing more so that you can pay it back later.
But education is intangible. What would the lender buy and then sell back to you? An appreciation of Faulkner? How do you calculate the value of that? This would seem to be one place where Sharia and personal finance just don't mix. But there's at least one place in the Western world where they do. England.
Now there is something worth considering. Islamic Bank of Britain. We make your money work hard, and our products and services are fully halal, so they're consistent with your faith.
Several UK banks provide some Sharia-compliant services, but IBB, Islamic Bank of Britain, was the country's first Sharia-only bank. Baron Junaid Abbas Bhatti is an Islamic finance expert who helped set up the bank's operations. He says non-UK residents can get standard accounts, but Brits can sign up for something special.
We have an equivalent of personal loans called personal financing.
How does that work?
It's very simple.
Actually, this is banking, so it's not simple. But it is fascinating, and it starts with metal. IBB constantly buys metal commodities. Now, say you need to pay for tuition at Oxford, worth, though, £10,000 sterling.
We'd sell you £10,000 worth of, say, copper, which we bought at wholesale price, and we'd sell it to you for £12,000. So we'd add a retail markup to it.
That markup is what the bank gets instead of interest. Now, you sell the copper for its wholesale cash value, 10 grand you can use to pay for school, but you owe the bank that 12 grand, which you pay off over time. In other words, the bank isn't buying and selling you intangible education, it's buying and selling metal. IBB has a team of Sharia scholars who sign off on the bank's products. Still, not everyone agrees this sort of transaction is, if I may mix my religious terminology, kosher. Economist Kabir Hassan.
In form, it is compliant, but not in spirit. Islamic finance, the essence, is not geared towards debt. It is more geared towards equity, partnership.
So in the future, we could see Sharia student loans that work more like venture capital. The lender would get a cut of the student's future earnings. If the student does well, the bank does well. Equitable risk.
And that is being discussed and analyzed, and hopefully that product will come out pretty soon.
Meanwhile, listener Asan Ahmed says he's glad Sharia forced him to avoid a student loan debt. Of course, not every Sharia-observant student can pay off their loans within 6 months of graduating. For now, in America anyway, they'll just have to have a little faith. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace Money.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
Well, it's time for a special edition of Getting Personal. That's when we answer your money questions. And with me, as always, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
How you doing, Tess?
Doing all right. And we're doing things a little different today. Marketplace is running this series on the Middle East. And so Chris is answering some of your finance questions about the Middle East. And our first caller is Renee, and she's in Minneapolis. Hi, Renee.
Hello.
What is your question about the Middle East?
Well, actually, my question has to do with a few months from now when I move to Doha, Qatar.
What are you planning to do over there?
Well, my husband and I have been offered a 2-year contract to teach in an American school in Doha.
All right. Well, that sounds like a terrific opportunity. So what is your question for Chris? How can we help you today?
Well, with this new move, there are, of course, a lot of perks. One being that housing is covered, healthcare is covered, also things like utilities will be covered, and then, of course, there's a 70-cent per gallon gasoline cost.
Oh, everyone, that's what's got everybody jealous.
Yeah, exactly.
Which will be interesting, but I still have looming college debt, and my gut reaction is to sink it into my college debt, which is about $12,000 right now, but what are your thoughts?
This is one of the reasons why there is this great attraction toward Americans going overseas for a couple of years to work, say, in the Middle East, mm-hmm. because there are these perks, there are these benefits, so you can create some wealth, and then you come back to the States, and you've really made a step up in your standard of living. So I would want you to take advantage of this period of time to have some retirement savings, like a Roth IRA, or just putting money into a taxable account with a broad-based equity index fund, because you'll have that extra money to do it. I don't know what the percentage is. Maybe it's 70% of your investment money is to attack this student loan debt, and 30% goes toward long-term savings. But I would still do the long-term savings component.
Uh-huh. That actually sounds a little more reasonable, though. Then I can kind of get some of that anxiety of the student loan and be working long term.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And save some money for yourself so you can have some fun while you're over there.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, whether you're heading north, south, east, or west, if you've got a money question, we'll hopefully have an answer. Just visit our website, we're at marketplace.org, and click on the Getting Personal link. All right, Chris, we've got an email from Mike in Enid, Oklahoma, and he's 26 years old, big believer in low-fee index funds.
I like this man. Never met him, but I like him.
He's currently got his retirement savings in the whole U.S. stock market, which is
the Wilshire 5000.
Wilshire 5000. He's also got EAFE, Developed and World Developing Indexes.
Okay. He's basically indexed the world.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, he wants to know if there's an index fund that focuses specifically on Middle Eastern markets. And if so, would he be better off just sticking with this whole world fund, or should he go ahead and look for this Middle Eastern fund?
There's growing interest by individuals to put money into the Middle East. It's not that easy. So there are two approaches to take. One is what we'll call a derivative approach, which is you invest in one of these commodity indexes, because obviously oil is big in the Middle East. So that's one way to play or invest in that part of the world. There is an ETF, exchange-traded fund, which is an index fund, and it's Middle East and Africa, and the symbol is GAF. You know, to my mind, there are really two bets on the Middle East. I mean, one is a short-term bet, which is high price of oil. Your longer-term bet is that a number of these Middle Eastern nations will be able to take that oil wealth and transform it into other forms of wealth, whether more sustainable, whether it's in financial services or in real estate, other kinds of businesses that will provide more jobs and opportunities for a middle class.
Well, there you go. We hope that helps, Mike, and thanks for writing in. Let's hit the phones again. Steve is on the line from New York City. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Tess and Chris. How are you?
Good. How are
Good.
You doing?
Good.
I understand you've got a question for us.
Well, both my wife and I are U.S. citizens. We both work for companies in the U.S., and both of our companies are thinking about relocating us to the United Arab Emirates. And we'd both go over as professionals, but still keep our house here in the U.S. And we've both heard that there is a possible tax break, an $80,000 of your first salary, which is not taxed on U.S. taxes. And my question is, number one, would that apply to us? We've heard mixed things from people in our corporation. They say, well, if you're still working for a U.S. corporation and you still have a U.S. residence, that doesn't apply to you.
Right.
Okay. Now, as I understand it, the first $80,000 of foreign earned income is excluded. And then for your spouse, by the way, it would be $160,000 because you would double it if you're both working over there. But the issue is that it's foreign earned income.
It doesn't matter whether he's working for a U.S. employer or a foreign employer, whether his paycheck comes from the U.S. or from the UAE.
That's right.
Well, that certainly makes the opportunity more attractive to us. Is there some kind of time that you have to spend overseas before you're...
Oh, yeah. If you go over for a month, that's nothing. I mean, that doesn't count. I mean, this is for what we call expatriates. You've moved overseas for a period of time, a year, two, three, four, and you're earning your income overseas, and then you come back, you're repatriated.
Tess and Chris, thanks very much. Big help.
Thanks so much for your call, and good luck in the UAE.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye now.
Bye. All right. Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. So send them on over. Just visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Just ahead, the Dubai Dream Revisited.
The wives come and go, wow, this place is great. We're moving tomorrow. You know, and then you get here and you live here and reality sets in. You go, oh.
And Scott visits the pyramids.
Oy, wow.
That's me getting on a camel. The camel's the one that sounds like Chewbacca.
But will he get fleeced by his tour guide? It's the Middle East meets Middle America on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and I'm joined by my colleague Scott Jagow, the host of the Marketplace Morning Report. He joins us from Cairo. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Tess.
So this week on Marketplace Money, we're bringing you part of a special Marketplace series called The Middle East at Work. There are almost 3 million Arab Americans in the U.S. Most are Christian, but the Muslim population is growing. And because Islamic finance is kind of tricky, we're devoting some time to explaining the nuances of buying a mortgage, setting up a student loan, and even managing your stock portfolio.
Yeah, but Tess, the one thing I keep hearing about is the restrictions on stock picking.
That's right. There are all kinds of rules. So there are a couple of strictly Islamic mutual funds out there to make it easier for people. One is the Amana funds, and they've been around quite a long time, a couple of decades, actually.
Do you know how they perform?
Much better than your average mutual fund, actually. I wish I had invested in them. For the income fund, the five-year return is about 19%. So to find out more about Amana, we're joined by Maneem Salam. He's the head of Islamic investing for Saturna Capital, which manages Amana. Mr. Salam, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, the Amana funds invest according to Islamic law, Sharia. What do you actually look for when picking a stock?
Well, there's actually two basic criteria that we're looking for. The first one is trying to avoid companies that are making their revenues primarily from something that's forbidden in Islam. You know, as alcohol, Muslims are not allowed to drink it. We're also not allowed to invest in it. And the same can go for gambling companies, pornography, pork products, And the one that's fairly unique to Islamic investing, which you don't find in other ethically based funds, are financial companies. So we don't have any banks, insurance companies, and those types as well.
And is that because of the laws against interest?
That's correct.
Tell us a little bit about Amana. I know there are other Muslim mutual funds, but how did you get started?
Well, Amana actually started about, it's the oldest and largest in the U.S. It was started back in the 1980s. And what basically happened was is that in Indianapolis, there was an investment club that was formed for local Muslims in that area.
An investment club just like your average people just gathering to invest together?
Yes, that's right. Huh. It was just a regular average investment club made up of Muslims. And when they started it, they realized that there was such a big demand for it and they couldn't really keep up with it. And pretty soon they became so big they couldn't be an investment club anymore. So they went to the local mutual fund expert. His name was Nicholas Kaiser. And they approached him and said, hey, we'd like to start a fund. And he said, well, I know a lot about starting funds, but I have no idea about Islamic investing. So if you can teach me about Islamic investing, I'll teach you how to start a fund.
And what is it worth now?
It's a little bit under $1 billion.
And what did it start at?
The initial, I think, deposits were about $250,000.
Wow. And how are the funds performing currently?
The funds are doing great. Over the past 3 or 4 years, we've also had a very good performance as well. We have our own fund management criteria, which is a value-style investing. And so we're long-term holders. We don't sell a lot of companies. We try to buy for the long term. And because of that, we kind of spotted the commodities boom a little bit early. We stayed in, and we've been able to benefit because of that.
Given the fund's performance, I wonder what other non-Islamic funds might learn from this kind of screening process.
One of the things they can learn from us is how we actually do our research. Because we have to really know where the revenues are coming from for a company. Because one of our criteria, for example, is a total debt to market capitalization. And when you talk about total debt, you have to also include off-balance sheet debt as well. And so we really have to investigate a lot to figure out exactly how much debt a company has and then really look at whether we can buy it. I think it's helped us and saved us a number of times. Case in point, for example, would be a WorldCom or Enron. Mm-hmm. We did invest in Enron initially. We saw that their debt levels were getting high, especially when they factored in the off-balance sheet debt. And we sold it, and shortly thereafter, you know, everything exploded in Enron.
For listeners who are hearing about this for the first time and thinking to themselves, wow, I might want a piece of that, is it fairly easy to invest in Sharia-compliant funds, either through, say, a 401k or even a 529 plan?
No, it's very difficult. What we've tried to do over the past years is work with a lot of companies to allow the amount of funds to come in. However, we haven't been very successful. So when we go out and we educate Muslims and otherwise about investing, what we tell them is there are alternatives that are available. Alternative to a 401k would be an individual retirement account, an IRA. An alternative to a 529 plan would be an education savings account, an ESA. They're just a matter of getting educated about how you can access the amount of funds through them.
What is the objection that you find from mutual fund providers to including you as an option?
Well, the majority of the objections are in misunderstanding exactly what the fund is. A lot of times people think that, oh, we only invest in, companies that are Muslim or that are Islamic, and that's not the case. The other reason also is that we are a no-load fund. There's no commissions that you pay on the front end or on the back end. And a lot of times, the bottom line for the broker is, how do I get paid? And if he can't get paid, then he doesn't want to offer the fund.
Muneem Salam is Director and Vice President of Islamic Investing for Saturna Capital. Thanks so much for your help today.
Thank you very much.
For a list of Muslim financial institutions here in the U.S., visit our website at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more online at saveandinvest.org.
Everything in Dubai is about being the biggest, the best, the record-breakingest. Perhaps you've heard about the indoor ski resort, the world's tallest building, and the giant map of the world made out of artificial islands. Dubai is billing itself as a place where dreams come true. Sounds like something Disney would say, but the pitch is actually working. Every year, tens of thousands of people come to Dubai to be part of the dream, to live and work there. But this desert paradise that came out of nowhere, can it really make good on its promises? Or are people in for a rude awakening when they arrive? As Sean Cole tells us, depends on who you ask.
A map of the world made out of islands is nothing. That thing was finished back in January, or the first phase of it anyway. And 9 days later, the state-owned company that built it, Nakheel, unveiled its latest project at an annual tourism conference.
Nakheel brought you the world. Now, we take you to the universe.
That's right. Islands shaped like planets and galaxies.
Now, being in real estate, now, there are certain moments in life you come to a place and you're saying, wow. And Dubai is certainly a place of wows.
Robert Lee is the executive director of Nakheel. He's also really representative of the new Dubai, a Korean guy who grew up in Canada and landed a senior position at a government company.
Dubai has been a desert place. There is no natural monument. Dubai doesn't have the Grand Canyon. Okay. The value we have with the world islands, it's not the real estate. It's how people talk about Dubai.
The dream of Dubai is living in a place that builds islands shaped like stuff. The dream of Dubai is skiing for a couple of hours at the mall and then hitting the beach the same day. The dream of Dubai is living in a luxury villa by a man-made lake. But some people who've moved here will tell you that the villas and the dream are pretty shoddy. People like Jan Robertson, a housewife from the UK. She's had a lot of trouble with her house.
Quality's really poor, yeah. Water pouring in when it rains. And then there's the water tanks, they burst on a regular basis every 3-4 months.
I talked with Jan at a country club where she has breakfast with friends every Wednesday. They're mainly the wives of guys in the oil, construction, and financial industries, Brits and Americans alike. They talk and laugh and sometimes complain. And the day I was there, Jan and her friend Heather Johnson complained that the dream of Dubai is just something their husband's companies told them, so they'd move there. This is Heather.
They do like a wine and dine. Bring the wife out on us, you know. We'll take her out and we'll show her a good time. So the wives come and go, wow, this place is great. We're moving tomorrow. You know, and then you get here and you live here and reality sets in. You go, oh, it's expensive here. It's expensive to go out.
Plus, their husbands have to work 6 days a week. There's no genuine culture here, Jan says. The British school her kids are in is good, but she's paying a lot for that too.
So you don't think the dream of Dubai matches with the reality?
No, I don't at all. Not once you actually live here.
Nonetheless, people are climbing all over each other to live here. A report from the Dubai financial group Schwa Capital says that the population of this city grew more than 50% between 2000 and 2005. And one of the reasons it gave was pretty simple, almost sweet. It said people just like the Dubai story.
They love it. They love it. It was a desert, and they made something of this desert. I mean,
Rania Afifi wrote that report.
There are trees in the desert. They managed to bring down the temperatures here by 10 degrees Celsius. That's incredible. Any architect with a really funky idea can come here and realize his dream. They motivate you. Why not love the story?
It sounds like you really love the story.
I do like the Dubai story. I do.
And because so many people want to be part of the story, the property market is through the roof, which has led to another aspect of the dream. You can make a lot of money here by flipping apartments or renting them out. Unfortunately, developers can't keep up with demand, and most of the residential projects in Dubai were delayed last year, including a Nakheel building that this woman invested in. She didn't want her name used.
But there was no compensation. It was a year late.
I mean, did you say, hey, like...
Well, I think you don't like to ruffle too many feathers because we are guests of this country. You've got to be a little bit careful.
What could happen? They could toss you out?
Well, possibly, yeah.
We probably have the largest customer relations center.
Again, Robert Lee of Nakheel.
And we treat everybody on the same basis. So please come and ruffle feathers. And the flip side, you should have asked her, how much money she has made in capital appreciation from our building, that should answer the question.
Actually, we did talk about that.
I've made 100% profit.
So the problems are outweighed by the benefit.
Yes, at the moment. But you've got to watch the bits in the middle, you know, otherwise they're going to outgrow their popularity then.
But for now, Dubai is the most popular kid on the block. And not just among expats who have money. There's a whole other Dubai dream that we haven't mentioned yet. One that has more to do with survival. Hundreds of thousands of the foreigners in Dubai are here to build the luxury apartments and villas and islands shaped like stuff. They're the South Asian laborers who are literally hammering the city's promise of prosperity together. For them, the dream of Dubai is just making a little money to send back home. And it is very little.
That's one of the main things that gets me down about Dubai.
This is Jan Robertson again.
And you see bus fulls of them, you know, and they've empty eyes. It sounds strange. You just look at their eyes, they're just empty. Sad, really sad. But that's how Dubai's been built, yeah? That's what they rely on.
And it'll probably be that way until Dubai has to adjust its boomtown mentality into something more sustainable, something more realistic, and less like a dream. In Dubai, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So the biggest complaint about living in Dubai seems to be the high cost of living. We thought we'd check in with a Dubai-based blogger named Colin Bramson. He said gas, not surprisingly, is pretty cheap, around $1.40 a gallon. Food staples like milk, for example, aren't too bad either.
Yeah, Tess, but a ribeye steak from the U.S. isn't cheap. It's about $10 a pound. Whew. And sirloin from Australia is around $8 a pound.
So it sounds like if you cook at home, maybe prices are more or less reasonable. It's when you decide to treat yourself to a night out that things start adding up. A so-so glass of wine is anywhere from $8 to $10. A beer isn't much cheaper. So really, it is the foreigners and the tourists in Dubai that are getting hit hard in the wallet. Now, Scott, you just had your own tourist experience in another part of the Middle East, Cairo, and it sounds like you had your share of difficulties.
Well, Tess, for me, the problem started as soon as I landed in Cairo. The passport computers failed, so we gave our passports to one official, then waited until someone else shouted our names. This took 2 hours. I spotted a European gentleman looking amused. He said he comes to Egypt all the time.
I see the pyramids once and never come back. It's a rich culture, but it's just politically so inappropriate that nothing works.
I wasn't ready to throw in the towel already. My colleague Amy Scott and I just got our passports.
Amy? Scott?
Amy Scott?
Yes. Woohoo!
The next night, we took a ride on the Nile in a little sailboat called a felucca. The ride cost 50 pounds, about $10 for 4 people. Our guide was Abdullah. He told us how he sleeps in the boat and how cold it is and how much he loves Americans. He said the word tip a lot. Then he sang for us. We had a great time. We pooled our money for a nice tip, 50%. But Abdullah was singing a different tune. He wanted more money. I gave him a couple extra pounds.
Two more.
Yeah.
No good bakshish. No good.
Bakshish means cash. As we walked away, Abdullah was still complaining about the tip. I asked a Cairo tour guide if this kind of thing hurts the tourism business. Last year, 10 million foreigners visited Egypt. Nora Abdel Khalik said Egypt is trying to limit the harassment. For example, at the pyramids, the government has increased the number of tourism police. They're supposed to protect visitors from getting fleeced by the Bedouins who offer camel rides.
Tourists feel much more safer than in the past. And the camel people, or those Bedouin people, they are under control. If anything happens, and it's much better than in the past, really.
Okay, let's find out.
Wow.
That's me getting on a camel. The camel's the one that sounds like Chewbacca. Our camel guide was also named Abdullah. And he told us how he loves Americans, and he constantly asked me if I was happy. We got off near the Sphinx, and now he wanted 5 times as much money in American bills.
But I like American money. Because I love the Greek
color. We don't have American money, sorry.
We have Egyptian money.
Have a look. Take this. Give me 100.
No, I don't have 100. I don't have American dollars. I don't have American dollars.
Yeah, no, give me another 100. Take this back. Give me
you can't see it, but right now, Abdullah is trying to put his hand in my wallet. I see a tourism officer approaching. Thank goodness. But what does he do? He asks me for money. I didn't give him any. I did pay twice as much for the camel ride. I asked other tourists about their experiences at the pyramids. Sarah Abharan said she was born in Egypt, but this was her first time back in 50 years.
I saw a policeman on a camel, and I told him, can I take a picture of you? So he said, yeah, sure, why not? And then he told me, don't you think my camel needs money?
But Sarah says this is just part of the Egyptian culture.
You don't want it? Don't come here. That's what I say, you know? Or you take it or you don't take it.
And some people, like John and Sue from Britain, said they didn't have any problems. Well, maybe one.
Overall, how would you rate your experience here so far?
Well, we get hassled by American journalists all the time.
You can see a video of my camel ride and negotiations at marketplace.org.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Thanks for joining me, Scott, and safe travels back to the U.S.
Thank you. It was my pleasure, Tess.
And next week, Marketplace continues our look at the Middle East at work. We know business is booming in the region.
Globalization has not reached this extreme situation anywhere else in the world.
But for how long?
Should one incident happen, building blown up, a hotel blown up, a car bomb or so on, the whole experiment would fail. The foreign direct investment would leave overnight.
The Middle East at Work is produced by Nancy Fargali. Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas. Our production team includes Megan Larson, James Richter, Rico Galliano, Janae Darden, Amy Scott, Miguel Macias, Ravi Carmen, Eric Johnson, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
وسائل الإعلام الأمريكية.